It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson's here. Boy, does he have a lot to talk about, a lot of tech news, including that hack on the one-armed bandits, on the slot machines. What's going on with the iPhone apps? Thousands of them, apparently, or at least hundreds that are hackable. Steve will give you the story and the mitigation and, of course, all the security news. Coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 598, recorded Tuesday, February 7th, 2017. Two Armed Bandits. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow. And use the code SN30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. And by Bowl & Branch. For a good night's sleep, try their ultra-soft 100% organic cotton sheet sets. Get $50 off your first set of Bowl & Branch sheets and free shipping by visiting bowlandbranch.com and entering the code SECURITYNOW. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security and privacy news. With this guy right here, Stephen Gibson of the Gibson Research Corporation. He's armed and ready with with his super triple quadruple venti latte.
You betcha. Hey, Leo. Great hey, to be Steve. With you again.
Good to see you.
Episode where we're closing in on number 600. This one is 598. And I named this one Two Armed Bandits. And in fact, we're kicking off here on time, and I just got the I'd forgotten even to set the intensity and camera settings, so people are going to be annoyed that I didn't tweet the show note link beforehand. If anyone is like wondering where it is, it's the same format as always, but it's 598 rather than last week's 597. So I'm sorry for not putting it into my Twitter stream. I'll do that in 2 hours once we're done, but. Anyway, there was a really fun story that was perfect for the podcast about a problem with one-armed bandits, which of course is the fun term for slot machines, not being random enough and Uh-oh. The consequences of that, which is how we'll wrap this up. But we had a lot of news, as we have been for the last few weeks. Speaking of the devil, because, of course, last week was traitors in our midst, 150,000 printers around the world got hacked.
Wasn't what precipitated the show? That was after the show?
Yes.
Oh. Wow, you were prescient.
So a little bit of prediction there. We also have Vizio's TVs that have been the corporation has been slapped by the Federal Trade Commission when it was discovered what they were doing, that they really were watching their watchers. Microsoft has an unpatched zero-day problem as a consequence of not responding to the security researcher who found it within 90 days. Hopefully – we're going to have to wait a week because this is one of those months where the second Tuesday, Patch Tuesday, is as late as it could possibly be because, you know, they missed the first Tuesday by 1 day. Last ones, of course, was January 31st was our last Tuesday. So so this is the first Tuesday of the month, meaning that maybe they're going to get this fixed. And then I just love this story. Some researchers examined camera footage of people using the Android pattern lock and realized, you know, that's really not hard to guess what their pattern is. And so they demonstrated that in a research paper that we'll discuss. An arsonist's pacemaker ratted him out. We have a survey finding that many iOS apps are still not checking TLS certificates and the consequences of that. The courts have just made a ruling on Friday, which has created new confusion in the email search warrant mess. You and I imagine you and Jeff may want to talk about this because it involves Google. We'll talk about that ourselves here in a second. We have a bizarre blast from the past that actually predates the podcast. There were actually security events, Leo, before the Security Now podcast.
What?
Even though this seems like it's been going forever. yes, this was the sequel Slammer Worm has returned.
I remember Slammer. Yeah.
Cellebrite's stolen data has started to surface. We talked a couple weeks ago about how 900 gig had been exfiltrated from them. Now we have some sense for what it is, and it's not actually very impressive. There's some worrisome movement in the encrypted web extensions debate, another topic that you and Jeff and company may want to discuss. I think it was Business Insider? Financial Times? I can't remember who. Anyway, we'll get to it when we get to it, about just reminding us that non-Windows 10 users are still not alone. I'm going to answer a couple quick questions. I have a report and recommendation without reservation of a new sci-fi author and series that I finished. I was up till 2:30 a.m. and then 3:30 a.m. on the final two nights last week, Wednesday and Thursday. I just could not make myself stop reading it, and I ended up finishing the fourth book in the series, and it was really fun.
Wow.
A bit of miscellany, and then we'll talk about two-armed bandits ripping off one-armed bandits.
Another fabulous show on the way, but of course, before we get into the meat of the matter, we should take a little break and give Steve time to rev up with his little... Now, I don't understand. You have two different coffee cups. You have the big Contigo or
yes,
whatever.
Yes, that's the storage tank that keeps okay. the coffee right. hot. And then I transfer
to Lavazza cup.
I turn it in my Lavazza cup, which rests on my Walt Disney Mickey Mouse very hot coffee warmer that's burned me on several occasions.
You have a Mickey Mouse coffee warmer?
Yeah. Yeah. You can see I don't.
I can see it. Yeah. It looks hot. Don't burn yourself.
Oh, it is hot. And there's Mickey's in one of his ears is getting a little.
You've had that for a while. Yeah.
Not long enough, actually, but I have several of them because it turns out it's like the hottest one there is.
You know, you drink a lot of coffee when you wear out the warming pad that you put your coffee cup on is actually worn. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. This is a loan approval process that's completely online from the mortgage lenders that are the best in the country, quickenloans.com. And all you have to do is go to quickenloans.com/securitynow and see all those J.D. Power awards year after year for customer satisfaction. They're the highest in customer satisfaction. And not surprising, not just for origination, but also for servicing. I mean, these guys are good. Quicken Loans. And they know that people like us want to do everything we do online, right? We don't want to go to a lender and hat in hand and bring a box of paperwork and all of that stuff. We'd like to do it all online. That's what Quicken Loans is all about. Whether you're buying a new house or refinancing, you can do it on your phone, on your tablet, from your couch, from the open house, from anywhere. It's friction-free, as it should be with online. And it means you can get approved for a loan in minutes that matches your exact criteria. In fact, it's so customizable that they have little sliders when you're doing this that you could choose your rate, you could choose your term and all of that stuff. You play with it to get the payment you want. I just love it. And you can submit all the paperwork online with a touch of a finger, whether it's your pay stubs or your check statements. I love Quicken Loans. You will too. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. Go completely online. QuickenLoans.com/security now. QuickenLoans.com/security now. We thank them for their support of Steve's Fine Podcast, which was the other name we were thinking about.
That's right. Steve's Fine. Steve's but it didn't podcast. Have... Yeah.
No.
So the picture of the week I got a kick out of. This was actually... This was taken off angle from the large presentation screen in a security presentation. And just for the heck of it, I removed the perspective distortion, but it still has some parallelogram distortion that I didn't get rid of. I was like, okay, well, the message is coming through anyway. Anyway, so I got a kick out of it because, this was in the context of the problem that we continue to have. I mean, arguably we will always have with well-meaning notifications that users are supposed to pay attention to because this is important. I mean, of course, the classic example was remember how my own operations manager and bookkeeper and accountant and Girl Friday, who's like made my life possible for the last – she's been with me now for 23 years, how I set her up with a mirrored RAID disk array and it started complaining that one of the drives was dead and, press enter to continue. And so she did for about another couple years. Until the second one finally died. And then when I said, well, Sue, the whole point of having two drives is that if one dies, then you can limp along on the other one.
Like, fix it.
But you should let me know. And as it happens, that turned out to be a SpinRite recovery story I was able to share because even though both drives had completely gone belly up, I ran SpinRite on the most recently dead one because, of course, it had the most recent information, and SpinRite was able to recover it, and we lost nothing. But I said to Sue, okay, listen, if you, anytime something like this happens again, the point is there's an early warning system here. So don't just say, oh, look, I can get my work done if I just say okay. So this dialogue in the title, it says, website certified by an unknown authority. Okay, whoops, wait a minute. Which now would be an indication, our listeners know, of a man-in-the-middle attack. Something has intercepted a connection such that the identity of the other end was not verifiable. So, of course, what the user sees is the dialogue that just reads, it's got the yellow triangle warning, something happened and you need to click OK to get on with things, which, that's how everyone just sort of says, well, OK, how do I just get rid of this annoyance? And then in the details, it says certificate mismatch. Whoops, I just hit the space bar and page down by mistake. Certificate mismatch. Security identification, administration, communication, intercept, Lilliputian, Snotweasel, Foxtrot, Omega Force.
So this is a real error message?
No. I mean, they're just sort of saying, nobody reads this crap.
Yeah, yeah. And then it was some program does this, says this.
I think somebody made it up for the presentation.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
My
favorite part is this, is the button.
Exactly. The button, and we've all seen this. This button is labeled technical crap, dot, dot, dot.
So if you want that, you can
so
get it. Yeah.
If you haven't had enough yet because Snotweasel, Foxtrot, Omega Force wasn't sufficiently confusing, and then there's three radio buttons, more technical crap, Hoyven.
Hoyvenglaven. That's Jerry Lewis.
Hoyvenglaven. Yes. And then the third one is launch photon torpedoes, meaning nobody reads this. All they get is, wait a minute. Where's my document? What do I, okay, fine. What, do I push okay or cancel? What, just get this out of my way. And so we have this is just sort of a fun reminder that we have a fundamental problem with this, with the the breach, the gap that exists between our systems, which are designed by people who know what is important, and you know, and basically we've made the dialogues look pretty because users want, you know, 3D and shadowing and so forth, but we still haven't managed to solve the underlying problem, which is essentially users don't care and they're just going to click through. Yeah. And so ultimately this stuff has to be designed. I mean, if you literally take the word or the expression foolproof, you know, break it down into two words, unfortunately, that's what we need is somehow to make this stuff just foolproof. That is, don't try to tell them, don't teach them. That was always my techie friend Bob's biggest complaint. Or not, actually, it was the complaint of the people he was working with, because he was always trying to teach them what this stuff means. And they're like, no, just what button do I push? Just, I don't want to know this.
Don't explain it. Just tell me what to do.
I don't want to go to college or school of Bob. I just I want to know how to make the lights turn green. And he'd just shake his head and say, well, then you're on your own.
I give up.
So last week, the topic of the podcast was traitors in our midst. And independent of that, and it had to have been going on already. It couldn't have been inspired by the podcast, because I looked at some of the work this person did, and it's some nice scripting. A security researcher who calls himself Stack Overflowin', with no G, Stack Overflowin', wrote a script to scan the internet for printers publicly exposing their IPP, which we discussed last week, Internet Printing Protocol, LPD, the line printer data port, or port 9100. Just scan the net. Now, there was, again, misreporting as a consequence of people taking literally sort of his joke, like what he had printers print. But in the last week, I've received a bunch of tweets from people. There's also a fun one, Leo. There's a link. I didn't turn it into a link. It's a Twitter picture below that first picture from Priscilla. She tweeted, the printer for our POS, and I'm assuming that in this case she means point of sale.
Yeah, yes, not piece of
yes. Systems at work got hacked. And she says, LMAO. And then she posted a tweet, which is actually shows a strip of point of sale paper.
Yes, carbon paper too. I mean, it's
with this thing. And so it says read, Stack Overflowin, the hacker god, has returned. Your printer is part of a flaming botnet operating on Putin's forehead, utilizing BTI's Pred's break the internet complex infrastructure. Okay, none of that is true, but he was just having fun. And so one of them shows a terminal and then a computer, and then it says, and the screen says, hacked, LOL, just kidding. And that was one of the messages that he had 150,000 printers around the globe print. And then on the on the next page of the show notes is a different message where he did an ASCII art bot and basically said the same sort of thing. So, so first of all, there was no botnet. Nothing was technically pwned or owned. But what was surprising, although it shouldn't have been from our reporting last week, is that 150,000 printers are publicly exposed, including this POS system. It's like, why would you have your port exposed? And then I thought about it, and I thought, okay, you know, there's a takeaway for our listeners, because our advice Leo, yours and mine for more than a decade. We can say that now because we're in year 12 of the podcast. Disable universal plug and play. That has been our mantra, because that universal plug and play is now a widely used interface on the LAN side of routers, which is enabled by default because they want to be helpful and they don't want tech support calls, and everybody else does it, so why shouldn't they? It allows any device on your LAN to make itself public. That's arguably what it was for. Now, Microsoft gets away with this. This was their standard because they've also got a firewall in the PC. So they're able to be a little more careful in using universal plug and play. But people understand, you can log into your router and you can deliberately map ports inside. That is, you're able to essentially bypass the router's network address translation firewall, stateful firewall, meaning, and we've talked about this often, that unsolicited packets are ignored. It's only packets returning from an initial outbound connection, which are automatically allowed back in and are then routed to the original sending machine. But there are some things like Skype, for example, back in the peer-to-peer days of Skype and gaming, where in order to be on a gaming network, they're greedy with the ports. They need, there's like four or five ports you need to have opened. And so because that was too hard, I mean, and arguably, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't. It's a problem that where convenience and security are colliding. Because on one hand, your Xbox wants to have some ports exposed that we're trusting it to handle responsibly. So it uses universal plug and play to open those ports behind our back. That is, the router has it. It's enabled by default. Any device, there's no security. That was the controversial feature of universal plug and play, because again, they opted for ease. There is no security on it. So a device on your network needs no permission to talk to your router and say, and in this case, we're talking about a printer. This has to be how 150,000 ports are open. Printers are trying to be helpful. They're saying, oh, what if you're roaming and you want to print to me from out on the public internet? Well, if you're going to do that, I have to make a port open. So when you connect your printer in your LAN, it reaches out to the router and opens ports behind your back, exposing it to the internet, which is where 150,000 of these ports came from, most of them probably unintended. So we've had an example of the number of printers that are probably exposed, and the fact and mechanism by which printers are able to make themselves public without their owners knowing it. One thing you can do, because we know what these ports are. The port for the Internet Printing Protocol, IPP, is TCP 631. For LPD is TCP 515. And for the RAW protocol is port 9100. Now, because those are not, and it's time maybe to revisit this, because these are not your typical widely used service ports like FTP and SSH and web and so forth, they're not in GRC's Shields Up small port list. They are on the service port list, so except for 9100, because I go up to a little bit above 1024, but not up to 9100. So if you did a full service port scan, look to see if 631 and 515 are showing as open, in which case something in your network, probably without your permission or knowledge, has opened those ports and is listening to. Of course, maybe you already got the robot ASCII art in a couple days ago, and so you know that somebody somehow got into your printer. The point is that this was just – they just used it as a printer this time. But this is a nice heads up saying, okay, you got your warning shot. Your printer's exposed. And we know from what we talked about last week, from the research that was done, that because, for example, PostScript is a full Turing qualified language that is able to execute code, you just don't want your printer exposed. It creates an opportunity for someone to get into your network, onto your LAN with a computer, because, of course, printers are computers.
Is it sufficient to turn off UPnP?
I would say turn off UPnP and reboot. You could check from the advantage that any port scanner like Shields Up provides is it's got a public facing view. You really can't see what's going on inside your network because there's just so much going on. What matters is what's exposed to the public, and so. Shields Up will, by looking back at your IP address, will give you a warning if anything that you're not expecting is exposed. And so it's worth doing a little Shields Up scan every few months just to make sure that nothing you've added, none of the IoT devices has gotten up to any mischief. But, unfortunately, if we had a quiet LAN, if it was the way it once was, where all we had was some probably well-behaving PCs from conscientiously responsible security-oriented companies, then you could like, okay, well, that's probably okay. But now we've got Vizio TVs and light bulbs and the whole IoT thing. So, and we know that many of these companies are not being responsible about security. So if we give them access to universal plug and play, it's just game over. They'll open ports for that. They will argue to provide functionality that their users want. But the problem is, in doing so, it creates entries into our network. So the problem is, if you disable universal plug and play, some stuff might break. Something might stop working. Now, that alone is a useful test to verify that device was requiring universal plug and play. Normally, it's possible to create your own static mapping. That's the security conscious gamers don't just turn on universal plug and play in order to get their Xbox to be connected into the big network. They've, they look at the five or six ports that are necessary and they manually map those to their Xbox, and they get the same functionality without just letting it be open for the whole network. And really, the fact that there's no security, that's the concern. But it was a choice, a trade-off that was made. And arguably, it was made, as I said, at a time when there was less potential vulnerability in the LAN, because it was just going to be some Windows and Mac PCs, not not refrigerators. Someone sent me a tweet of a Walmart slow cooker that had Wi-Fi access, and it's like,
I just got a Wi-Fi connected oven,
right? Yeah, I think I watched you, and you were talking to Stacy about that last Wednesday.
The June oven. And actually, it's funny because I'm ready to cook last night. I had salmon steaks all out, and the oven wasn't working. It was in a boot loop. So I went online in the June, they have the chat support, and I said, it's in a boot loop. I said, oh, yeah, you need to reset your oven, unplug it, hold down the button, and reboot. And I've seen the Android screen for refresh, you know, reloading the bootloader and refreshing the ROM. So I refreshed the ROM, and it all worked again. So we, I mean, we really, it's amazing, you know. And it won't work unless you're connected to the Wi-Fi. It gets recipes and stuff.
What could possibly go wrong? So speaking of Vizio and IoT, the Federal Trade Commission has slapped them. I consider this a slap because it was $2.2 million. Actually, there were two types of
The FTC action happened several years ago. Vizio settled today. That's the news story.
Oh, okay. That was the news. Yeah. Okay. Good. So...
So we've known about this for a couple of years. But what's interesting is Vizio agreed not to do it anymore. I wonder if they kept doing it until they settled. I don't know.
I'm not sure about the timing here.
I'll look it up and I'll give you a readout.
So the FTC said consumers have bought more than 11 million internet-connected Vizio televisions since 2010. But according to a complaint filed by the FTC and the New Jersey Attorney General, consumers didn't know that they were watching their TVs, that while they were watching their TVs, Vizio was watching them. The lawsuit challenges the company's tracking practices and offers insights into how established consumer protection principles apply to smart technology. So then it says, starting in 2014, Vizio made TVs that automatically tracked what consumers were watching and transmitted that data back to its server. So I think you're right, Leo. It does mention that they retrofitted older models, but this sounds like probably shortly after that behavior was found, the FTC said, okay, hold on, folks.
Yeah. And they're going to delete everything collected before March 1st. So.
Correct.
Of last year.
Correct. Yeah. What I liked, there was a little bit of interesting information here, and that was that on a second-by-second basis, Vizio TV was collecting a selection of pixels from the screen that it matched to a database of known television, movie, and commercial content.
Yeah. Otherwise, how would they know what you're watching?
Yeah. I thought that was just like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, so they went to some serious effort in order to track people. And of course, you know, the set itself might, if it was the tuner, it would know what you were tuned to. But if it was just the screen,
Right.
So if you had another piece of equipment doing the channel selection and tuning or a DVD player, it would be like, okay, what movie is this? And so the idea of actually capturing video off of its own screen and then, you know, sending it back for identification is just like, okay, well, they put some effort into this.
This is a long-standing practice, I got to point out. We, 15 years ago.
This level of monitoring?
Yeah, 15 years ago, we were offered at the Tech TV data from people's TiVos that had second-by-second viewing graphs of what they'd rewound. And TiVo's been, you know, at the time, and I imagine still does, was selling that to networks for programming. It's like ratings.
Yeah.
And so that's that. And now it's a little interesting that the monitor is doing that. And obviously they have to jump through more hoops. The TiVo know exactly what you're watching, right? I bet you anything Roku has that information. Apple TV has that information.
Yeah, I think they're monetizing it. You're right.
Of course they are. And, yeah. It's like ratings. And, you know, it's better than ratings. It's gold.
Right. And the FTC's argument was that consumers didn't understand. And they called it, Vizio called it smart interactivity feature, although it didn't actually provide smart interactivity. So again, the FTC, and I mean, you know, we've been talking about recent FTC actions, and it, for example, like in going after who was it? The the router maker, D-Link, I think it was. The FTC was stomping on D-Link. And I think that's going to be the arm of enforcement that we rely on for beginning to hold companies accountable for their behavior, because you know that's what we've got here in the U.S.
You know, it's interesting that you know as the FCC rolls back all of its regulations under the new administration, one of the things that they seem to want to do is to put all of the burden of this on the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. And former Commissioner Tom Wheeler, in a really good interview with Susan Crawford yesterday on Back Channel, said that that's been the goal all along, because the FTC is swamped because they have to do everything from dishwashers to microwave ovens, and they have an enforcement arm that's deceptive practices, but it's not going to be sufficient to protect net neutrality or any of these other things. But that, but so these all these companies like Comcast would just love the FTC to be in charge of enforcement, because they know that they'd be,
because they know nothing never would hear be from able them. To happen.
Yeah, right. Well, look at this action. This is stuff Vizio started doing in 2014.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Yeah.
So a security researcher, Laurent Gaffey, gave Microsoft a 90-day heads up to patch a flaw he found in, and this is, you know, this is just now, a Windows client processing of the server message block, the SMB protocol, which is better known as Windows file and printer sharing. And of course, this is a long, this is a core Windows Microsoft protocol that's been around forever and has also been a constant source of problems. There were some stories a few years back of, because Internet Explorer would actually honor SMB:// URLs, it was possible for websites that wanted to fingerprint their visitors to put an SMB:// URL in the web page, and that would cause a server message block connection from the user's computer back to the website. And through that, you got all kinds of information. So anyway, so Laurent gave Microsoft 90 days. Microsoft did not respond in 90 days, and so has just posted a Python proof of concept, which allows a malicious server to crash a Windows client. And that's effective through Windows 10. I don't know how far back it goes. In the coverage, I only saw Windows 10 and Windows 8.1. So I don't know one way or the other whether Windows 7 or, for example, XP would also be affected. However, US CERT has further warned that their vulnerability could do more than just crash a system, which, of course, is not surprising to us. As we know, these things start as crashes, and then when hackers look at them very carefully, they're able typically to extend that from just sending the program off into the wilderness, which is what we call a crash. It's extended into having the program execute code which they provide. And in this case, US CERT has warned that it can also execute arbitrary code with Windows kernel privileges. And the reason is the SMB protocol is deeply wired into the OS. So it is the kernel which is making this connection. And so if you can do some sort of a buffer overrun style vulnerability, then you're executing code with the permission of that service, which in this case is SMB. I'm hoping, because this, you know, I mean, this is not show-stopping end of the world, because it does require that a client establish a connection to a server. The problem is there appear to be many ways to make that happen. So because it is the core protocol in the core networking and communications protocol in Windows, it's always there, and we have a long history of exploits against it. So I'm hoping that that the 90 days, like essentially that Microsoft needed 97 days. That is to say that next Tuesday's Patch Tuesday will fix this, because there is a it's on GitHub now, win10.py, a very nicely written Python script which pretends to be a server message block server and is able to crash any Windows machine that reaches out to it. And as we know, and as US Cert said, today it crashes it, tomorrow it could be executing code on it. The question, I think, the big question is there still a way to get a website to cause Windows to make an SMB connection? I immediately researched that when I saw this story, and it wasn't clear. That most of the coverage is many years old where this was happening, and I'm hoping that that's not the case. There is a mitigation, and that is we know what SMB protocol uses. It uses TCP protocol over ports 139 and 445, and UDP over ports 137 and 138. So if you're in an enterprise and your responsibility is the security of your enterprise, and you don't have a reason for machines in your intranet, in your LAN, to be connecting to remote SMB servers, and you know that if you do, you probably need to rethink your architecture, because that's just a scary thing, because SMB has been such a trouble-prone protocol. My point is, if you don't know you need to permit outgoing connections to remote shares, remote SMB protocol, then blocking TCP 139 and 445 and UDP 137 and 138, that would be prudent. And that would prevent this until Microsoft has it fixed. But again, it would just be better not to permit that unless you have a definite use case, because then you're ahead of the game, not waiting for vulnerabilities to surface, but being protected from them beforehand.
I think this is when we met was NetBIOS vulnerabilities.
Yes. Yes.
15 years ago.
Those quaint email scripts, yeah. You know, it's like, that's so cute, running scripting. And again, I was railing. I mean, I was a broken record at the time. Who needs scripting in email? Turn that off. And, you know, it took 5 years. And finally, Microsoft said, maybe that's not a good idea. It's like you think? Okay, so I love this, Leo. You will, too. I remember the first time I saw Android's, you know, grid sequence lock. I thought, that's kind of cute. You know, you put your finger down. It's a 3x3 grid of dots, and you trace out some interconnection pattern among the dots. And it's like, that's kind of cool. That seems it's different than at the time iOS's 4-digit passcode, which they've extended. It's easier than typing in a long passphrase. You just sort of do a little swipey thing and your phone is unlocked. The problem is, the moment I saw this research, I thought, oh, that's just so cool. Because if you think about it, looking at someone do it, even if you didn't see the screen, there's not sufficient ambiguity in their actions. And it turns out that the more complicated the sequence is, the easier it is to crack. And so if you and what the research did was these guys showed that from 30 feet away, just by looking at video that like in standard static security cameras in Starbucks or wherever, somebody who's holding the phone in front of them, where you're just able to see the motion of their hand with 95% accuracy, it's possible to deduce the sequence. And of course, the reason is that as you swipe around, if you go up, then you know that you had to have been down in order to go up. And if you go up twice, then you know that the down where you were was all the way down, because there's only three levels. And the same thing for left and right. So, for example, if someone did a little tiny square in one corner, well, okay, there are what, four possible locations on a 3x3 grid where a 1x1 square could be drawn. And you typically have five chances before you're locked out from guessing wrong. So it's very clear that there just isn't enough ambiguity if anyone can see the relative motions of your hand. So in the abstract of this research, and by the way, the paper is on, I got the link in the show notes, is on Google Drive, is just beautiful. They show a whole bunch of little 3x3 grids with lines drawn on them to demonstrate what, you know, how unambiguous these things are. In the abstract, they said, pattern lock is widely used as a mechanism for authentication and authorization on Android devices. This paper presents a novel video-based attack to reconstruct Android lock patterns from video footage filmed using a mobile phone camera. Unlike prior attacks on pattern lock, our approach does not require the video to capture any content displayed on the screen. Instead, we employ a computer vision algorithm to track the fingertip movements to infer the pattern. Using the geometry information extracted from the tracked fingerprint motions, our approach is able to accurately identify a small number, often one, candidate pattern to be tested by an adversary. We thoroughly evaluated our approach using 120 unique patterns collected from 215 independent users. By applying it to reconstruct patterns from video footage filmed using smartphone cameras, experimental results show that our approach can break over 95% of the patterns in five attempts before the device is automatically locked by the Android OS. We discovered that, in contrast to many people's belief, complex patterns do not offer stronger protection under our attacking scenarios. This is demonstrated by the fact that we're able to break all but one complex pattern with a 97.5% success rate, as opposed to 60% of the simpler patterns in the first attempt. Since our threat model is common in day-to-day life, this paper calls for the community to revisit the risks of using Android pattern lock to protect sensitive information. Anyway, I just thought that was, you know, it's the kind of thing where, again, in retrospect, it's like, oh, yeah, that would not be that difficult to do. But it's so sort of, you know, so it's somebody who wasn't thinking about the attack angle, so to speak, said, oh, this, you know, this is interesting and different and fun. Unfortunately, it's just not very secure. If anyone can see you even from a distance, do it. There isn't much guesswork involved in figuring out what you did.
They kind of acknowledge that when you choose your screen lock, they say they rank them from least secure, which is the pattern lock, to the most secure, which is a strong password. So people do get a little bit of advice anyway from Android when they set that up.
And probably people, again, as we know, people are A, not actually that concerned about right. their security. And it's like, and we'll opt for convenience.
They want something you can do with one hand. You know, the nice thing about pattern lock, you do with one hand.
Yep.
So
yep.
if somebody is in the situation, they're a strap hanger or whatever, and they need to, on the subway, you know, and they yeah. need to use one hand, they almost always will choose a pattern lock. And usually it'll choose very easy to deduce patterns. John C. Dvorak was always trying to figure it out from the grease on my phone. You know, like, because if you do it enough, it will kind of form a pattern on the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Network World had some reporting on this, and I paraphrase it a bit. And this is their title was "Cops Use Pacemaker Data to Charge Homeowner with Arson and Insurance Fraud." They wrote, "Police called they said if you're dependent upon an embedded medical device, should the device that helps keep you alive also be allowed to incriminate you in a crime? After all, the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects a person from being forced to incriminate themselves. Nonetheless, that's what happened after a house fire in Middletown, Ohio. WCPO Cincinnati, which is a TV station, caught video of the actual fire, as well as they delivered the news that the owner's cat died in the fire. And then they editorialized, as a pet owner, it would be hard to believe that a person would set a fire and leave their pet to perish in that fire. The fire in question occurred in September of 2016, so a few months ago. The fire department was just starting an investigation to determine the cause of the blaze. A month later, 59-year-old homeowner Ross Compton was arrested and charged with a felony aggravated arson and insurance fraud. The cause of the fire was still undetermined, but it had resulted in $400,000 in damages to the house and contents of the 20,000-square-foot home. Fire investigators knew there had been, quote, and this was suspicious, multiple points of origin of the fire from the outside of the residence. At the time, the police cited inconsistencies in Compton's statements when compared with the evidence from the fire. There were additional conflicting statements given to the 911 operator. Compton had said, quote, everyone was out of the house, yet the 911 operator also heard him tell someone to get out of here now. The 911 call published by WLWT5, an out-of-breath Compton claimed he had, quote, grabbed a bunch of stuff, threw it out the window. He claimed to have packed his suitcases, broken the glass out of bedroom window with his walking stick, and tossed the suitcases outside. Compton also told the dispatcher he had a, quote, an artificial heart, which he didn't have. After this, things really got interesting because police investigators used data from Compton's the term is pacemaker elsewhere. So Compton's electronic heart device against him. And the question is, isn't that self-incrimination? Can a person plead the Fifth when it comes to self-incriminating data collected from their medical device?
I don't think so. I'm no judge, but
I agree.
They can collect your fingerprint. I don't know why they couldn't collect pacemaker information.
Yeah, I agree. So, police set out to disprove Compton's story about the fire by obtaining a search warrant to collect data from Compton's pacemaker. WLWT5 reported that the cops wanted to know, quote, Compton's heart rate, pacer demand, and cardiac rhythms before, during, and after the fire. Then on January 27th, just 2 weeks ago, the Journal News reported that court documents stated, quote, a cardiologist who reviewed the data determined it is highly improbable Mr. Compton would have been able to collect, pack, and remove the number of items from the house, exit his bedroom window, and carry numerous large and heavy items to the front of his residence during the short period of time he has indicated due to his medical conditions. Middletown police said this was the first time it had used data from a heart device to make an arrest, but the pacemaker data proved to be an, quote, excellent investigative tool. The data from the pacemaker didn't correspond with Compton's version of what happened. The retrieved data therefore helped to make the indictment. So Yes, another instance of, I mean, you know, we've talked about malicious attacks against things like insulin pumps and pacemakers in the past. But, you know, and then we were just recently talking about somebody who there was a murder in a hot tub, and at between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m., some huge amount of water was monitored and recorded from the person's IoT water meter. And so we're seeing increasing instances where, you know, police are being creative in gathering forensics evidence from all of the electronic things that surround us. Yikes.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a sip of coffee, Leo.
Oh, good thinking. Because I want to surround you with some electronic information from our fine sponsor, IT Pro TV. If you're an IT professional or you want to become an IT professional, IT Pro TV is the best way to learn. Everybody knows this is a hot area. If you listen to this show, I think you're probably already a believer. And by the way, I know a lot of you are very interested in security. IT Pro TV has some great courses for security, for pen testing, certified ethical hacker. What is IT Pro TV? Well, let me pull it up here. ITPRO.TV/security now. That's the website to go to, ITPRO.TV/security now. And when you get there, you're going to see, something a little bit like TWIT, a live channel streaming great information about technology Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Thousands of hours as a result of great programming about all of these subjects. And you have access not only to the live stream, but to all of those programs in their course library. 2,000 hours of content and 30 more hours every single week. By the way, if you want to stream live, you can on your Chromecast, your Roku, your Amazon Fire TV, your PC, of course, and they have a brand new Apple TV app, which is fantastic. Certified Information System Security Professional. CompTIA's Project Plus. Ethical Hacking Version 9. Coming up, AWS Solutions, Pen Testing, Networking Plus. They've got transcripts, just like Steve does. They've got transcripts of everything. So you can search for the transcript and jump to that part of the presentation, which is nice if you want to study up on something specifically. The National Youth Cyber Education Program. Cyber Patriot. Oh, this is great. They're doing some really neat stuff here, I have to say. IT Pro TV. Take advantage of their low monthly subscription price and their no-hassle cancellation policy. And they had to do that because originally it was all about, you know, getting the cert so you could get the job, and afterwards you'd cancel. But now I think many people, even after they get the cert, keep their subscription because it's a great way to keep up on your field and to branch out and increase your skills to make yourself more valuable, right? Because you could have it like on the Roku, on your big screen TV running all the time at home. You get in the car, you listen on the phone, you get to work, you have those courses right on the screen. Boss walks by, he says, "What are you doing there, Smithers?" "I'm studying pen testing, boss." "That would be great, Smithers. We could really use a guy like you." Just think of that. Premium okay, maybe not exactly like that. Premium annual memberships, normally $57 a month, $570 a year. But we got a special deal for you. A free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account when you go to itpro.tv/security now and use the code SN30. Take advantage of this now, by the way, because they're going to introduce a new membership level soon, and all current premium members will be granted the highest level available. So you'll get the new level at the same price if you sign up now at itpro.tv/security now. And don't forget to use the offer code SN30 so you get 30% off forever. itpro.tv/security now. What are they doing? They have 5 studios. I'm so jealous. So jealous.
You have what you want, Leo.
I do. I don't need 5 studios. Right now they're doing, let's see, they did CCNA Cyber Ops this morning and JavaScript. They're doing Network Plus right now. So cool. I know. What would I do with 5 studios? I got 2. That's plenty.
I do hear from our listeners who are now members of IT Pro TV, and they like it a lot.
Well, a lot of them are your fans, actually, because there's just kind of overlap in the content, right?
Yeah.
When we went out there, everybody said, say hi to Steve. Say hi to Steve.
So Will Strafac, S-T-R-A-F-A-C-H, Strafac, maybe?
I guess. I was talking about him, too, earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. The president of the pseudo, I love that, the pseudo security group, as in S-U-D-O.
And by the way, well, you know, Renee told us on MacBreak Weekly this morning, well-known guy, highly respected. So,
yep.
So listen, what he's saying is right on.
Yep. He posted, well, and he's got an interesting service that that we'll talk about that they're just in the process of launching. So he posted yesterday on Medium. He said, during the development of our web-based mobile app analysis service, and that's what we'll talk about in a second, called Verifyly, it's at Verify.ly, so Verify.ly, Verifyly, which is now, it's got a page up, so listeners can go check it, Verify.ly. He says, it was essential to have a clear understanding of the most common security issues which plague mobile applications today. Automatically scanning the binary code of applications within the Apple App Store en masse allowed us to get a vast amount of information about these security issues. Okay, so what they've got is they've got a static binary analyzer that scans Apple iOS applications looking for problems that it's able to identify just by doing a first degree automated reverse engineering of what the code apparently is. He says, I will present some findings within this post, which I believe to be in the public interest, related specifically to iOS applications which are vulnerable to silent interception of normally TLS-protected data while in use. Our system flagged hundreds of applications as having a high likelihood of vulnerability to data interception. But at this time, I'll be posting details of the connections and data which I was able to fully confirm as vulnerable using a live iPhone running iOS 10 and a, as in quotes, malicious, meaning, you know, his own test proxy server, to insert an invalid TLS certificate into the connection for testing. So to take a break here for a second. So what he's talking about is that, you know, as I have been, it's been my most oft repeated fundamental, is that without authentication, all you have is the illusion of security. If you do not know to whom you are speaking, then the fact that you're encrypting your data means nothing, because modern encryption negotiates keys on the fly and for security. But if the person you're negotiating that on the fly key with is a bad guy and you don't know it, then it's self-defeating. So what this static analysis found was 76 popular iOS applications that do not verify the identity of the certificate to which they are connecting, which means an illusion of security, but no actual provision of security. So he lists some highlights from what he found. During the testing process, he writes, I was able to confirm 76 popular iOS applications allow a silent man-in-the-middle attack to be performed on connections which should be protected by TLS, and in this case HTTPS, allowing interception and or manipulation of data in flight, in motion. According to Apptopia estimates, there has been a combined total of more than 18 million downloads of app versions of those iOS applications which are confirmed to be affected by this vulnerability. For 33 of the iOS applications, this vulnerability was deemed to be low risk, meaning that all data confirmed to be vulnerable to interception was only partially sensitive analytics data about the device, partially sensitive personal data such as email addresses and or login credentials, which would only be entered on a non-hostile network. So about half of them, a little less than half, that while they weren't vulnerable to not verifying the identity of the certificate, it wasn't a horrible problem. For 24 other of the iOS applications, this vulnerability was deemed to be medium risk, so that they were able to confirm the ability to intercept service login credentials and or session authentication tokens for logged in users, which of course we know would allow an impersonation attack, very much like in the old days of Fire Sheep. For 19 of the iOS applications, this vulnerability was deemed to be high risk, where they confirmed the ability to intercept financial or medical service login credentials and or session authentication tokens for logged in users. And we've been speaking in the last couple of weeks about Apple's App Transport security feature, ATS. It turns out that does not contain and help block this vulnerability from working. He posted in detail, and I'm not repeating here, the low risk, those 33 low risk applications, but he's withholding the names of the 24 medium and 19 high risk applications for responsible disclosure process. So the publishers of those applications have been notified and are being given time to fix this discovered problem before that's made public.
And they're only low risk because they don't hand over important information. It's the same mechanism all around, right?
Correct.
Yeah, it's just what information can be extracted.
Right. So in digging into this, I was like wondering, you know, why can't Apple and their App Transport Security, the ATS, and iOS simply enforce certificates? For example, you know, we're used to platforms that do that for us. Like down at the OS level, if you have said to the OS, make me a connection over to here, then that comes back failed if the handshake and the verification doesn't work. You get back an error saying invalid certificate, and you're not talking to those people. So he explains, he says, this class of vulnerability poses a complex problem, as application developers are the only ones, this is the key, application developers are the only ones who can fully mitigate it. It's derived from networking-related code within iOS applications being misconfigured in a, as he puts it, a highly unfortunate manner. Due to this, Apple's App Transport security mechanism will see the connection as a valid TLS connection, as it must allow the application to judge the certificate validity if it chooses to do so. There's no possible fix to be made on Apple's side, because if they were to override this functionality, that is, if the OS were to enforce it, as I was suggesting, in attempt to block the security issue, it would actually make some iOS applications less secure, as they would not be able to utilize certificate pinning for their connections, meaning that, you know, certificate pinning allows an application the freedom to obtain the certificate and get the fingerprint of the certificate, which is unforgeable, so that they're able to lock themselves to a given certificate remotely. He says, and they could not trust otherwise untrusted certificates, which may be required for intranet connections within an enterprise using an in-house PKI, public key infrastructure. Therefore, the onus rests solely on app developers themselves to ensure their apps are not vulnerable. So there's like no solution except and this is why what's being done here by the pseudo group is so good, is they've proactively scanned apps, developed candidate potential vulnerabilities, then verified them manually. Because so their automated system can raise red flags, but then they need to verify that it wasn't a false positive. They do that, then they're notifying the application developers and say, look, you need to lock this down. You've got X amount of time to do so, because we need to, as a responsible security research firm who's discovered this, we need to let people know if you don't get it fixed. So the only workaround he offered in the interim, and of course we don't know which applications are vulnerable at the critical, or at the medium, or the high level of vulnerability, so we don't really know what we should be protecting against. But he said, as a workaround, disable Wi-Fi during sensitive transactions. He said there's a short-term trick which can be used to mitigate this type of vulnerability. The vulnerability is very likely only to be exploited if your connection is flowing over Wi-Fi, whether you've joined a public Wi-Fi network or a determined hacker has force joined your mobile device to a rogue network without your knowledge. Therefore, if you are in a public location and need to perform a sensitive action on your mobile device, such as opening your bank app and checking your account balance, you can work around the issue by essentially opening settings and disabling Wi-Fi prior to the sensitive action. While on a cellular connection, the vulnerability does still exist. Cellular interception is much more difficult, requires expensive hardware, is far more noticeable, and is quite illegal within the United States. Therefore, it is much less plausible for a casual attacker to risk attempting to intercept a cellular connection. So, and then to companies he addressed, he says, if you offer an application in the iOS App Store, consider analyzing builds prior to App Store submission using our Verifyly service. This class of vulnerability and all other possible low-hanging fruits, meaning vulnerabilities discovered to a determined attacker or discoverable by a determined attacker who commits 24 hours of total analysis time, that not deep analysis, can be fully detected by performing an automated scan of the binary code and giving you an easy-to-read report outlining any and all flagged issues, ensuring your customer data is safe. And then the end of his post, he talks a little bit about Verifyly. In fact, I went over to see what this was all about. And their site explains that Verifyly allows you, and by you they mean an app developer, this is not for the end user, to scan the binary code of an iOS application to produce a human-readable report detailing all detected common security issues and a breakdown of all useful security-related information pertaining to the app. The app scan is performed in seconds using our proprietary automated static analysis engine, yielding actionable information regarding the security of the scanned mobile application. No source code is required. And then, for example, under features, they have detects all common CWEs and mobile OWASP top 10 issues within an app, detects hard-coded sensitive content that is easy to reconstruct, API keys and secrets, encryption keys, passwords, and more, detects any use of malicious, private, or risky APIs, detects issues related to SSL and TLS validation, like was the subject of this posting, detects issues with sensitive data at rest, stored non-securely, detects code hashes against databases of known malicious code, and generates easy-to-read report explaining issues and displaying relevant data in a high-level manner to ensure reliability to ensure readability by the widest and potentially non-technical audience. And this sounds like it's in the process of coming online. They offer a professional plan for $100 a month, which is a single user account. A small business plan for $500 a month is coming that allows 10 users per account. And then for an enterprise class plan, they say contact them. So a nice looking service. And this is I'm just glad to see this, Leo. It's the kind of broad based, automatable, binary based testing that allows a company like this to provide a service of saying, this is not as your app doesn't look to us like it's as secure as it needs to be.
Yeah, I like the name too, Verify.ly.
Yeah. So, somewhere, maybe it was there, I saw something about it being a problem that, like, one of the ways this is happening to developers is there is this drag and drop approach, which is becoming increasingly prevalent, unfortunately. And that is that developers who are, at deadline, under the gun, in a hurry, they will grab a blob of code off of GitHub or somewhere that has some functionality that they don't fully understand. They didn't write it, and that's the point, is they just grabbed it because they needed this chunk of function, and they drop it into their app just assuming things about it which are, is not in evidence, and they get themselves in trouble as a consequence of code having behavior different than they expect. For example, not verifying certificates. They just assume it's being done and don't know one way or the other. So they get themselves and their app in trouble.
This is really common. Remember, the flaws that were exposed. I can't remember if it was OpenSSL where they cut and paste Intel reference code or the baseband radios. Because why rewrite it? Somebody wrote it. There's the code. I can get it from Stack Overflow or somewhere. And
yeah.
why
I think it might have been a whole bunch of routers that all
that was it,
had
the routers.
They just took a chunk of code that was clearly marked by Intel as this is just to demonstrate how to talk to the registers of our hardware chip. This is not for production.
Don't do
but
this.
But it was like, oh, it works. we compiled it and it worked.
Yay.
So
we'll
shipped
it.
Yeah. So last Friday, 5 days ago, confusing things further, muddying the waters, a U.S. judge ruled that Google, unlike the decision that had been reached for Microsoft, must turn over foreign emails. And this is from I edited this down from Reuters reporting, and boy, the logic is tortured here. A U.S. judge has ordered Google to comply with search warrants seeking customer emails stored outside the United States, diverging from a federal appeals court that reached the opposite conclusion in a similar case involving Microsoft that, of course, we all discussed at the time. U.S. Magistrate Judge Thomas, and his name is Reuter, R-U-E-T-E-R, in Philadelphia, ruled on Friday that transferring emails from a foreign server So here's the tortured logic. From a foreign server, so FBI agents could review them locally as part of a domestic fraud probe, did not qualify as a seizure. The judge said this was because there was, quote, no meaningful interference, unquote, with the account holders' possessory interest in the data sought. Quote, through the retrieval of the electronic data by Google from its multiple data centers abroad, though the retrieval of the electronic data by Google from its multiple data centers abroad has the potential for an invasion of privacy, the actual infringement of privacy occurs at the time of disclosure in the United States, this judge wrote. Google replied in a statement Saturday, that is over the weekend, the magistrate in this case departed from precedent and we plan to appeal the decision. We'll continue to push back on overbroad warrants. And this ruling came less than 7 months after the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, which is what we discussed at the time, said Microsoft could not be forced to turn over emails stored on a server in Dublin, Ireland, that U.S. investigators sought in a narcotics case. That decision last July 14th was welcomed by dozens of technology and media companies, privacy advocates, and both the ACLU and U.S. Chamber of Commerce. A few weeks ago, on January 24th, 2017, the same appeals court voted not to revisit the decision. So they were staying by it, and it had already gone to appeal, and they said, nope, we're sticking by it. The four dissenting judges, however, called on the U.S. Supreme Court or Congress to reverse it, saying the decision hurt law enforcement and raised national security concerns. Both cases involved warrants issued under the Stored Communications Act, a 1986 federal law that many technology companies and privacy advocates consider outdated. In court papers, Google said it sometimes breaks up emails into pieces to improve its network's performance and did not necessarily know where particular emails might be stored. That's going to be a hard one to substantiate, of course, because if you want to retrieve your email, you can. So obviously Google knows how to find it. Relying on the Microsoft decision, Google said it believed it had complied with the warrants it received by turning over data it knew were stored in the United States. And, you know, in background, Google receives more than 25,000 requests per year from U.S. authorities for disclosures of user data in criminal manners, according to Reuters. To Judge Reuters' ruling. So, you know, and the takeaway for our listeners, you know, is email is not secure and arguably not securable. If you want to exchange messages securely, then TNO is the only solution. Write the message in a simple editor, encrypt them yourself using a high entropy key that you arrange to share with the other party out of band, and then send that encrypted blob however you want. If you write your message, you encrypt it yourself, then it doesn't matter what you do with it. You could send it by Pony Express, by Donkey, by unencrypted email. It's just a blob of binary that nobody can ever access except the person who has the matching key. And so, you know, that's the way to do it. I saw a lot of people all excited about Ladar Levinson's email service coming back online. And it's like, okay. None of this ever moves me. In fact, Google even has a hosted S/MIME service that they're putting together to make it, you know, to increase the security of email in transit by using TLS-style authenticated connections. The problem is that as soon as it moves out of that protected environment, and if it's stored encrypted, and Google's announcement of this hosted S/MIME service says, yes, you know, we store it under our own encryption. Well, that means that a judge can say, okay, and we'd like you to decrypt it now, please. So TNO applies to messages in the same way that it applies, as we've been discussing now for years, to user data stored in the cloud. At the moment, it's more of a manual process. But I would argue if something you if you need to send something to someone and you actually do care about it being secure, then trust no one. Encrypt it yourself, and then it doesn't matter how you send the blob. Nobody will ever be able to see what's inside there.
It could be pretty much automated. I mean, if you have GPG, GNU Privacy Guard, it pretty much automates the process for you. So it's about as easy as can be. Once you've got somebody's public key, you can even say every communication I have with them should be encrypted with this key.
Right.
You know, so
right. So if both endpoints are going to be communicating,
that's the only
challenge.
Is, you know,
yes. And famously that was the whole Edward Snowden and Greenwald.
Yeah. Glenn Greenwald couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. Right.
What do you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
So a blast from the past department, and actually is a bit of a blast. We have the return of SQL Slammer, of all things. Checkpoint's blog noted that starting on November 28th of last year and running through December 4th, so just until month before last, Checkpoint observed a huge spike in the long-dead SQL Slammer networking traffic. Okay, so what was SQL Slammer? This predates, this actually, as I was saying at the top of the podcast, it actually predates the podcast. 14 years ago, back in 2003, many web servers using SQL database were misconfigured to expose the standard SQL query port, which is 1434, to the public internet. So, you know, a web server does want to expose port 80 and 443 for doing web services. It probably has processes running on the server which want to connect locally to the SQL database using the local host 1434 port, but never intended for that SQL database to have the port 1434 made public. Well, it was. Microsoft SQL Server 2000 and the Microsoft Developer Edition Tools 2000 both exposed that port and had a buffer overrun vulnerability. And the reason it was so bad was it would work over UDP, which allows IP spoofing and single packet transactions. You don't have to do the whole TCP connection setup and everything. You're able just to spray UDP packets with abandon. And so what happened was the receipt of a single UDP packet containing this SQL Slammer worm at port 1434 would go into the server, blow the buffer, cause the execution of the packet, and statically, it would essentially run this a sub-process in the server that then itself began spewing that packet back out at random IP addresses all over the internet. So at the time, there was a huge number of exposed SQL database servers, and they all got found and the reason we call this a worm is exactly that behavior. A worm is by definition a self-propagating thing on the internet. And so someone somewhere sent one of these UDP packets. They launched this worm at one SQL server, infected it, and it started spewing these UDP packets at random that eventually found other SQL servers that were exposed, which in turn began spewing at random And before long, I mean, like almost immediately, the internet was filled with all this SQL slammer traffic, and all of the exposed SQL servers were found and infected and participating. And so, and if any servers were like offline for the weekend and then came in on, you know, came back up online on Monday, wham, they were getting slammed literally from all the other SQL servers when they happened to choose that server's public IP by chance. So it was quite a mess. Now here we are 14 years later, and Checkpoint noticed a return of SQL slammer, SQL slammer, and, you know, scratched their head. They don't know where it came from or why. What must have happened is that because old code never really dies, someone forgot about this being a problem, and for some reason, somehow, established a bunch of new Microsoft SQL Server 2000s on the internet, and somewhere there was probably an SQL server in a closet that never stopped scanning. Remember, we referred to this often as internet background radiation, IBR. There are these worms will never die. So somewhere there was one or two that didn't die. They just kept it, you know, sending out their SQL slammer UDP packet at random. Something else caused a population of Microsoft old, you know, what now? SQL Server 2000. So 17-year-old SQL Server to be brought up on the internet. And that closeted SQL Server ended up hitting them, and the worm began to live again. And as the population of infected machines grew, the rate of probes being sent out by all of those grew. And so it accelerated the rate of finding all the rest. And before long, there was a whole bunch of SQL slammer traffic on the net. So, you know, this is the way these things actually happen. Time for some more coffee, Leo.
All right. In that case, it's time for me to talk about my sheets. The softest, nicest organic cotton sheets in the whole wide world. I'm talking about Boll and Branch. Boll and Branch sheets are slept on. I don't know how they know this, but it's in the copy. So it has to be true by 3 U.S. presidents. There's 5 or 6, so it narrows it down a little bit. I tell you what, I sleep on them, and I love them. They're 100% organic cotton. They start out super soft and then get even softer over time. These are not, you know, those crisp sheets that practically bite you when you get in bed. You feel like you're in a cloud. I love them. And you can be, you know, feel good about these sheets because they use sustainable and responsible methods of sourcing and manufacturing. You're buying them directly from Boll & Branch. So the horrendous department store markup is gone. You go to the department store to buy sheets of this quality, you could spend up to $1,000. Boll & Branch, a couple of $100. And look at the beautiful packaging they come in with, a satin ribbon, this beautiful box. And I thought when I got them, I thought, oh, this must be a wedding gift. But it'd be a great wedding gift. You wouldn't even have to wrap it again. Go to Boll and Branch, BOLLANDBRANCH, like Cotton Boll, right? BollandBranch.com. Thousands of 5-star reviews. Oh, some beautiful sheet sets, too. Pick the style you like, and you're going to get $50 off your first set of sheets if you use the offer code security now. Boll, B-O-L-L, and Branch.com. Gorgeous sheets to make a great gift, too. Valentine's Day is coming. You want some love between the sheets? Well, start with the sheets. BollandBranch.com. Use the offer code security now to get $50 off your first set of sheets. It's funny. You know, we have other sheets, and I always know when I got the Boll & Branch on, and I love it. Oh, I go, oh, yay. It's Boll & Branch week. Steve Gibson, we are talking security on Security Now, as always.
We are indeed. So we talked a couple weeks ago about this big hack of Cellebrite, which is the well used by law enforcement mobile phone hacking service.
I saw a number of articles that said this is the one the FBI had used to get the San Bernardino iPhone, but I don't think we know that. I don't think we ever found that out.
Right. I don't think we know for sure, but we do know from the records that have been leaked that it's heavily used by law enforcement.
Yeah, they make a device that can suck the data out of any cell phone in seconds.
So nearly a terabyte, 900 gigs of phone hacking tools and databases and information of all kinds, we reported some weeks ago when the industry was covering this, were allegedly stolen from them. We're beginning to see some of this data surfaced. The hackers README in the public release of some of this noted that much of the iOS-related code is very similar to that used in the jailbreaking scene populated by a community of iPhone hackers that typically breaks into iOS devices and releases its code publicly for free. Jonathan Zdarsky, I always trip over his name, Jonathan Zdarsky, we've talked about him often, who's a well-known forensic scientist, agreed that some of the iOS files were nearly identical to tools created and used by the jailbreaking community, including patched versions of Apple's firmware designed to break security mechanisms on older iPhones. A number of the configuration files also referenced LimeRain, the name of a piece of jailbreaking software created by infamous iPhone hacker Geohot. He said he wouldn't call the released files exploits, however, meaning Jonathan said. Why can't I say that? Zdarsky also said that other parts of the code were similar to a jailbreaking project called QuickPwn, but that the code had seemingly been adapted for forensic purposes. For example, some of the code in the dump was designed to brute force PIN numbers, which may be unused, which may be unusual for a normal jailbreaking piece of software. Zdarsky noted, quote, if, and it's a big if, they used this in UFED or other products, that's the Cellebrite flagship product, it would indicate they ripped off software verbatim from the jailbreak community and used forensically unsound and experimental software in their supposedly scientific and forensically validated products. So this is really not a surprise. Essentially, this Cellebrite group are just vacuuming up all of the hacking and cracking work being done by the open hacking jailbreaking community, pulling it together, sticking their own label on it, and then reselling it as a package to law enforcement, apparently not really making many changes to it. So it's like, oh, well, you know, I mean, not a big surprise, but interesting to know that basically they're just recycling what's available publicly with a little more work. There was also Tech Dirt reported some worrisome movement in the encrypted web extension standardization process. We've talked about this a couple times. This emerging, it's called EME, the encrypted media extensions. I was going to say, wait, not encrypted web extensions, EME, encrypted media extensions. So there's an ongoing fight dispute essentially at the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, over encrypted media extensions, which is the HTML5 digital rights management scheme that several companies want incorporated, embedded in the web standards. And that fight took two worrying turns recently, reports TechDirt. First, Google slipped an important change into the latest Chrome update that removed the ability to disable its implementation of EME, the encrypted media extensions, which further neutered the already weak argument of supporters that DRM is optional. So it's becoming non-optional. And in the latest version of Chrome, no longer optional. But the other development is even more interesting and concerning. Dozens of W3C members and hundreds of security professionals have asked the W3C to amend its policies so that its members cannot use the encrypted media extensions to silence security researchers and whistleblowers who want to warn web users that they're in danger from security vulnerabilities discovered in browsers. So far, the W3C has stonewalled on this point. This weekend, the W3C executive announced that it would not make such an agreement part of the EME work and endorsed the idea that the W3C should participate in creating new legal rights for companies to decide which true facts about browser defects can be disclosed and under what circumstances. So that's a problem. One of the major objections to EME has been the fact that due to the anti-circumvention copyright laws of several countries, including ours, the U.S., it would quickly become a tool for companies to censor and or punish security researchers who find vulnerabilities in their software. The director of the standards body called for a new consensus solution to this problem, but not surprisingly, quote, the team was unable to find such a resolution. So, you know, there's headbutting going on. The new approach will be a forced compromise of sorts, in which instead of attempting to carve out clear and broad protections for security research, they will work to establish narrower protections only for those who follow a set of best practices for reporting vulnerabilities. In the words of one supporter of the plan, it won't make the world perfect. And this is a supporter, right? It won't make the world perfect, but we believe it's an achievable and worthwhile goal. So they're trying to come up to a compromise. But the argument is this is not a real compromise because by working to determine where the line should be drawn, it creates an important presumption or an implicit presumption that there is a line to be drawn. Having a policy is a tacit endorsement of the use of DRM for censoring security researchers to whatever degree. Because the argument is not about to what degree such use is acceptable, but whether such use is appropriate at all. So another battle here. Maybe we're going to end up coming out on the industry coming out on the right side of this. But boy, there is a lot of pushback from the content holders that want DRM to get pushed out to the browser. And if we have that, the question then is, when vulnerabilities are found, what happens? My take is that if responsible disclosure is criminalized, that is, you know, I believe researchers are still going to find, you know, going to be digging into this and finding problems. The question then is, what do they do with the knowledge that they gain? Because having done that is a criminal activity, which doesn't mean it won't happen, but it will mean that it gets forced underground. So I think disclosures will still be made, but unfortunately, they won't be able to be made responsibly. They'll be made anonymously and publicly, creating reputational damage for the companies who could have fixed those problems with under responsible disclosure prior to public disclosure, and also endangering end users who'll be using products with known public and unpatched problems. So it's a mess. And unfortunately, it really sounds like there is like a serious dispute that's not getting resolved at the moment in the W3C. I'm going to skip a few things that are sort of minor. And I found an interesting question I wanted to cover from a tweet from Passeride. He was asking for my thoughts on salting password hashes with characters in the username randomly and deterministically selected based on unhashed password. So this was interesting. This, you know, we've talked about salting passwords and the need for a per account salt. We were talking about it just last week. That if all passwords were salted, well, first of all, if all passwords were unsalted, that was a big problem. But if it was a global salt that was used that was mixed with the password, then the problem would be once that global salt was known, then you essentially had the equivalent of an unsalted password. The only safe thing to do was to obtain a random per user salt, which you store along with the user's account, and use that when the user puts their password in the first time, and then also when they put it in again. So Passeride is saying, okay, what if the salt is not random? What if it's derived from something the user puts in, like their name and the unsalted password? And I'm sure that close listeners to the podcast will realize that doesn't give us any protection. Now, using it and incorporating characters from the unhashed password complicates things, but it doesn't make it completely random. And so I do think it's clearly superior if the salt is unrelated in any way to what the user puts in. It's a completely random nonce, which is unique per user and isn't tied deterministically tied to information that the user provides. And then Matt Clare also asks, he says, why do botnets prefer IRC? And he suggests Tor hidden, too much work, XML too fancy, idling in plain sight safer. And he notes that he's been a listener since episode one. And I remember looking at this back in my early days of looking at DDoS attacks, and I realized that IRC is used for a couple reasons. It is a very simple protocol. It is implemented. It's been so old that it's been implemented in virtually every language. There's Perl script and Python, and I mean, you can find IRC chat clients everywhere. And IRC stands for Internet Relay Chat. So that's a convenience for botnets. What that allows is that allows botnets to all convene in an IRC chat room on a specific server or servers, yet to be controlled by the bot master somewhere entirely else. And the internet relay chat, because it relays chat over the internet, will automatically propagate the commands that somebody issues anywhere in the world in IRC to the server that is listening for incoming commands in that chat room. And so botnets prefer it because it is, as Matt suggests, it is simple to use, but it also has some strong benefits from in terms of the bot master hiding themselves. They never have to connect to the server where the bots are aggregating, they're able to use IRC itself to propagate their commands to the botnet, which makes it handy. And some final things. I did want to note that season two of the Expanse series has returned. A huge percentage of our listeners really liked the first season. It's based on a series of books that I read a couple years ago when I knew that Sci-Fi Channel was going to be producing it. And the series does stand out as remarkably high quality compared to most of the stuff that's there. I wanted to recommend a series of four books called The Intrepid Saga from an author, M.D. Cooper. He has a site called Eon 14, spelled with an A. So AEON14.com. That's all you need to know to find it. Eon, AEON14.com will take you there. Four books in the first set. There is a fifth one that I'm now anxiously waiting for. I don't have to wait very long. It's due out in April. But the fourth book ends that first set, so you don't have to worry about being left at a cliffhanger. On the other hand, number five will probably be ready by the time you are. I really enjoyed them, and especially the fourth one. It's good character development. It is sort of military sci-fi. Set in the far future, in the year 40,000 something. So the solar system has been fully populated. We've terraformed some worlds. Well, a lot of the planets have elevators going up to rings that are circling them. Really nice, rich, well-fleshed out future vision. And at this point, Sol's getting a little crowded, and so we're sending off world ships, you know, both first to terraform and then colony ships on multi-long missions with the colonists in stasis to go and spread humanity around. And so this is set in that sort of a backdrop. And it's very enjoyable, a very strong female protagonist, Tanis Richards. And I think people will like it. So, and boy, the fourth book, it just really comes together. It's almost like someone else wrote it. I don't know, maybe he came back from vacation or something before he wrote it, but it just grabbed me. So I can't say enough good things about it. The healthy sleep formula that we've talked about briefly and that has become extremely popular and helping a lot of people is in the process of being made into a packaged product. So it's simpler for people to take. HealthySleepNow.com for anybody who's interested. There's an Indiegogo project that's being put together. I'm not involved in any way, so I'm not making any representations about it, although the person who's doing it is an advocate of it and is soliciting people's feedback and input. So HealthySleepNow.com. What else I said? Oh, I did get a tweet from someone named Morgan Speck who copied me on a tweet to Hover. He said, "You did everything for me automatically," to Hover. "I see now why @SGGRC was raving about how great you all are. Thanks." And that gave me an opportunity to note that I just moved another domain. I have a domain beyondrecall.com, which I'll be using in the future as a spinoff, a secure, high-speed, secure wiping facility for hard drives and SSDs. I moved it from Network Solutions. I'm migrating all my stuff from Network Solutions over to Hover, and I did that just last week. And again, Hover, I'm so happy with the job that they're doing. I did get actually two tweets on the 1st of February, so the day after the last podcast, last Wednesday. It sort of held me in suspense. The first one was from a guy named whose Twitter handle is Arcane Code. First one came in at 6:09 a.m., and he said, "Not much longer, for SpinRite to run on this laptop, crossing my fingers, at SGGRC. So he wrote to me, and then he attached a Twitter pic that showed the box counting down the amount of time remaining. And then a little over about 3.5 hours later, at 9:29 a.m., he again tweeted, "Yay!" in all caps. SpinRite fixed my hard drive. My laptop now works without the hard drive constantly churning. Thanks, SGGRC. So that was nice to see happening sort of in real time, and a nice note to remind people that it's not only for data recovery and when you're worried that all might be lost, but when the laptop isn't working the way you think it used to, or the desktop seems to like pause for – that's actually a really scary sign. If your desktop seems to sort of freeze or pause for a while, there's no visual indication that your hard drive is having a problem at that time. But that's often what is going on. We know that because people run SpinRite, and then that all stops. So it was the drive behind the scenes, or the OS – trying, you know, like hitting a bad spot and working with the drive to deal with it. Running SpinRite makes the fix permanent. And lastly, two armed bandits. I got a kick out of this story because I knew our Security Now listeners would appreciate it. Wired.com provided the coverage for this, and Leo, you had already, I guess you had said that you and Lisa had seen this.
Yeah, Lisa is a slot machine player, so she had a serious interest in this overall.
So I'm just going to summarize this because we're just about out of time. Essentially what happened is Putin outlawed gambling because he thought that would reduce the amount of underworld activity in Russia. And that forced the resale of a large number of electronic slot machines out onto the market. That allowed the examination and reverse engineering of this large population of slot machines. And it was discovered that they were not using high quality hardware based, you know, like quantum level noise in a reverse bias diode that we were talking about just last week. They're using pseudo random number generators, and they're not very good. So as we've talked about the problem with pseudo-random number generation, it's why, for example, I don't use them in Squirrel, because if you are ever able to obtain a snapshot of the state of a pseudo-random number generator, then you can predict all of the future because it's just a software algorithm. And so – you know, I did a podcast, we called it Harvesting Entropy a few years back, where I explained in detail the way I'm avoiding that trap in Squirrel. Squirrel doesn't have a high need for randomness. Generally, it's just deterministic working from what the website generates. But when you create an identity, you want it to be an absolutely random 256 bits. So I arranged to do that with something that generates very, very high quality entropy, and not anything where taking a snapshot of it would allow you to predict the future. It specifically protects against that. Unfortunately, looks like from the coverage of how widespread this problem is, none of the slot machines that are in use are using high quality true random numbers. They are using something deterministic. And so here's how this works. I call this two arm bandits because the bandits themselves have two arms, but they are exploiting one armed bandits. The common designation for slot machines, by watching slot machines operate. And in the later attacks, using Skype to stream the video back to the exploiters who happened to be in, I think they were in St. Petersburg. I think they're in Russia. The current state of the pseudo random number generator could be determined just by watching the outside of the slot machine. First of all, I think that's unconscionable that the design would be so poor, but that's the story. So by essentially playing the slot machine for some length of time while capturing what it does, it is possible from looking at the series of outputs to reverse engineer fully the software state of the pseudo random number generator and then predict the future. So the way this was done was that the way it was first caught was the bad guys would hold their smartphone in their hand, and 1/4 of a second before they were supposed to press the button to stop the spinning of the wheels, their phone would vibrate. So the phone was set to vibrate 1/4 second before the slot machine would before pushing the button would cause a payout. And even though it was, you know, your timing might be a little bit off, so you wouldn't get a payout, but that was enough of an advantage, having the phone vibrate and the person as quickly as they could immediately push the button on the slot machine, biased it enough that these guys were generating tens and hundreds of thousand dollars a week in payout across the U.S. And later, because they were caught in the video surveillance of the casinos, they were caught holding the phone. They started wearing it in a shirt pocket and with an abrasive grill so that they would be able to feel it easily vibrate in order to make it less obvious what they were doing. But it turns out that because the randomness of the slot machines wasn't sufficiently random, and you could, by looking at the outside of it, you could determine the current state of its pseudo-random number generator inside. You could then predict the future, and that would give you a bias to substantially overcome the house odds and end up getting a lot of money out of the one-armed bandits.
Cool. Unless you're story. Playing nickel slots, in which case...
Cool, yeah, it's not going to be much money.
Not going to be much worth it. It is a great story. It just shows you the flaws in random number generators.
And these things generate so much money, Leo, they could afford a reverse bias diode in there.
Yeah.
Put a diode in. As I said, they must just be repurposed Pong machines or something from the 1970s. I don't understand. I mean, they're so expensive.
It's old Russian technology. It's probably Soviet technology. Here is, I thought, for you, your benefit, I thought you would enjoy this from Stack Overflow. They do an analysis from time to time on popular programming languages based on the number of questions they get. And the differential between languages used during the weekday and during the weekend.
Interesting.
People, unfortunately, during the weekday ask a lot about SharePoint and PowerShell and VBA. But on the weekends, it's Haskell and assembly language, baby.
Nice.
Number one and number two. So
yeah, you know, assembly's making a bit of a resurgence thanks to IoT, because these things have to be super cheap and money matters and cost matters, and there just isn't much room in those little things.
You know, Forth is also getting a little bit of a resurgence because of these little chips, these little Arduino and stamps and things. Forth is perfect for that.
It absolutely is.
Hey, great fun. Thank you, Steve. As always, you can catch Steve's act on his website, grc.com. That's where you should go to get SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility, and Steve's bread and butter. Make that yabba-dabba-doo happen, baby. You also, some places you make it rain, other places you make it yabba-dabba-doo. You can also find the podcast there. He has audio, 64 kilobit audio, and... uniquely transcripts so you can read along side by side. That's often the best way to consume the show. GRC.com. While you're there, there's a feedback form, grc.com/feedback. There's all sorts of great information. I could just go on and on, but it's a fun site just to browse around, explore, grc.com. We have audio and video of the show on our webpage, twit.tv/SN for security now. And, of course, you can watch us live every Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30, live.twit.tv, twit.tv/live, or now on YouTube Live at youtube.com/twit. However you like to watch it, you can also get it on demand. And you know that. Just go to our website or find yourself a place to subscribe, a podcatcher, and you'll get every episode. Two episodes away from number 600.
Woohoo!
Celebrating, what did you say, 12 years? That's about right, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Steve, thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.
Okay, my friend. See you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.